And what they will never know is that we have this, like, pre-recording of a failed episode that never happened. Like, they will never see the failed attempt.
Are we going to admit to that?
Nah. Hi, I'm Mark.
Hi, I'm Sophie.
And this is You Know What I Like, where we sit down each month and fail about something that we are unhealthily obsessed with. You Know What I Like, Barbarella. Barbarella was created by Jean-Claude Forest in 1962 as a serialized comic strip in the French periodical V magazine. However, it gained worldwide notoriety when it was bound and collected in 1964, causing many a scandal in its time.
Presenting the sexually liberated woman of the 1960s, Barbarella traversed the spaceways in her ship, sleeping with people of all genders and their varied places on the robotic scale, but most importantly, exploring the galaxy. Through a more modern lens, as with much classic media, the comic is not as scandalous as you might assume. The comic uses the convention of the silver screen and cuts to black wherever necessary.
However, the version of Barbarella that you are most likely more familiar with is the 1968 film that follows the same plot as the original comic, with Jane Fonda starring in the eponymous role. Known for its more garish colours, iconic costume designs, and more pervasive, explicit imagery, it ingrained the character into the public consciousness. Despite attempts to make a sequel and a musical adaptation, it is only in recent years that the character has made a return. Comics publisher Dynamite have launched a comic series written by Mike Carey and drawn primarily by Kenan Yarar that marks a return to the core of the character and pushes her back out into the universe. Okay, so in this episode, although we are primarily going to be talking about Barbarella, I do want to use this episode as a way of generally talking about problematic female leads. And to that end, I've also asked Sophie to watch the 1991 film Dogfight, but we will cover that in more detail when it comes up later.
Okay.
So Sophie, what is your background and experience with Barbarella?
Okay. So, I am very visually familiar with Barbarella. I, as we know, have a recurring fashion watch segment. So, like, I am, like, interested in fashion, but I'm not, like, a super fashion expert. But I had my 21st birthday, I want to say. Mm-hmm. I had a futuristic party. I always usually have, like, a theme for my birthdays, and everyone dresses up and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was looking at, like, costume inspiration and decor inspiration and stuff, I did a lot of, I created a Pinterest board, and that Pinterest board has a lot of Barbarella pinned to it.
Okay.
Because Barbarella has, you know, has such iconic fashion designs.
Yes.
Until now, I had always meant to watch the film, had never watched the film, haven't read any of the comics. That's about as far as my knowledge went.
Okay. My general experience came from the podcast called Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men.
Of course.
When they pointed out that one of the main iconic X-Men comic series. So, like, you know the character Callisto?
Yes.
And she has, like, an eye patch. She has, like, big black bushy hair.
Yeah.
And the very first storyline that she appears in, she kidnaps the X-Man called Angel.
Of course. And calls I see him where pretty, this is going. Pretty,
yes. Like, it's like the plot of Barbarella is
yeah,
her
like
first
100%,
story.
Yes.
So they pointed out that, like, it was like a riff on Barbarella. Like, and I was like, yeah. Like, what the hell is Barbarella? And then, like, it was, like, in the back of my mind as, like, this, like, iconic thing that I had no idea what it was.
Yeah.
So when I saw that Dynamite were doing a new series written by Mike Carey, who is like one of my favorite writers, like I was yeah. like, I'll give this a go. I'll see how it goes. And then like when I was first reading it, like I felt so conflicted like about reading it. Because like when I first read it, I'd not seen the film yet. So like I was very much like, there's a lot of sex and she's drawn to be very sexy.
Yeah.
But like this is a writer that I know who like respects women. So I'm very confused. So like I wanted to explore like that whole, that duality that can appear in like a lot of media.
Yes. Are we just going to dive straight in? Are we going to talk about how we enjoyed the film? Or are we just going to go straight into like this portrayal of women? Like, how do you want to do this?
Well, like we've not pre-talked about how you felt about these. So I'm really terrified about like if you liked them or not.
I with both Barbarella and Dogfight,
yes,
there are things I like about both of them and there are things I don't like about both of them.
Okay.
I feel like, okay, my general feelings towards Barbarella is, you know, Barbarella is like a cult classic insofar as it was not like...
Like it wasn't a hit.
It wasn't like a hit.
Yeah, yeah.
But it has been since been like taken on and a lot of people love it. I think visually, there are some really cool visual ideas in here.
Mm-hmm.
I love the fashion. I love a lot of like the set design, stuff like this. I feel like it has not got the most amount of a plot line.
I mean, I think that that's a fair criticism, yes.
There were times when I was like watching it and I was like, I am having a fine time, but like, where is the plot? Just, you know, a little bit.
Like, do you have, like, any main points at which, like, you thought that? Like, which segments of the film?
Well, I mean, the whole point is she's supposed to be finding Durand Durand. And there's just, like, a whole load of this film where she's just, like, wandering around.
Stabilizer's malfunctioning.
I've been repaired in reverse.
We're going in. I'll activate the terror screw.
It was very episodic, which when you say that it is based on a comic, I guess that makes sense because you are drawing on comic plot lines and stuff, and there would be episodes and it would all be building towards a larger confrontation, but it would be like an episodic narrative.
Well, the point for that, like, is that like it was in that, like it was like a strip in like a magazine.
Yeah.
So like it was like very, very much episodic.
And I feel like that really comes across in the film because the film, I feel like there are points when you sort of lose the fact that she's supposed to be finding Durand Durand.
Ouch.
Here we are and we're in this little episode at the moment and she's interacting with this person and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And like we do eventually get there, but I do think it's not the most plot heavy of films.
Like it's not very tightly plotted at all, no.
But like I feel like one thing I like about it is that it absolutely embraces like its absolute campiness.
Mm-hmm.
Like if they tried to play it straight, it would not have worked at all.
Oh God, yeah.
And so they've just gone full camp. We're not having, you know, it's not like the let's structure a beautiful storyline or whatever. It's just like she's gonna be sexy, she's gonna have some encounters, it's gonna be blah, and then like eventually we like sort of conclude the plot line.
Yeah, like it's not really like an exploration or like a statement on anything, like it's just like a fun adventure.
Yeah, and like I can at least respect the fact that like that's what it is and it's not pretending to be anything else and it delivers what it says on the tin.
Mm-hmm.
I probably would not rewatch it.
Okay.
But like I didn't hate watching it, it was perfectly fine. I have obviously got some conflicting feelings on our portrayal of women and sexuality and stuff like this.
Yes.
But like that happens a lot of the time when you watch films from like the 60s and stuff.
Yes. So like it does definitely frame itself as we said, like the sexually liberated woman like of the 60s.
Yes.
But do you think that that holds up?
Okay. I have so many, like, I have to start on point A and then I have to, like, work onwards.
Is it, like, point, like, 1 through 30?
I feel like my essential gist is that it is important to acknowledge that different things will be liberating for different people, and also things that were once liberating, we now recognize as not being so liberating.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I can see how in the 1960s, during this movement of, you know, the pills just being made available, you've got stuff like miniskirts, you've got this whole... leading towards sexual liberation, but one woman's sexual liberation is another woman's sexual oppression, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, like, I can imagine that there are a lot of people, specifically women, who, when they first saw this film, were probably like, oh, yay, a female heroine who embraces her sexuality, who has an active sex drive, who's shown to want and enjoy sex. Like, isn't that great and empowering?
Mm-hmm.
But then, with hindsight, we then look at these relationships, and my main problem with the relationships is that there's, like, I feel like there are sexual moments which Barbarella engages in, not because she actively, like when she has sex with the man with wings, she's like into it.
Yes. Pygar.
I will not remember anyone's names. I'm sorry.
Pygar the angel.
Pygar, you saved my life.
La la la. La da da. La da da da. La da da.
But then the revolutionary guy who wants to have sex the way that they do on Earth with the pill, she's just not interested. And there's like this transactional nature to the sexual encounters where it's like, rather than just being like, hey, we're both into each other, let's bang. He's like, you want my help in a thing. I'll only give you my help if you engage in this sexual activity with me. Mm. And she's not enthusiastic and she just does it and you can tell she's bored. And like, I have issue with those moments of sexuality when we're treating it like a transaction, which she is beholden beholden to doing, rather than, like, to me, obviously, my attitude towards sex is have as much sex as you want, as long as everyone is consenting and everyone is, like, an adult, then, like, go for it. But also yeah. have as little sex as you want.
Yes.
Because sometimes the problem with sexual liberation is that, and this happened in the 60s, there was a attitude of, if you're an empowered woman, you should be having sex all the time. Whereas there are lots of women who don't want to do that. And then there becomes this pressure that is put upon women to be a performing sex object in many ways, rather than just acknowledging that, like, different people have different sex drives. You can, like, you know, like, sometimes yeah. this liberation becomes weaponized against the people that it's supposed to be empowering for, and then it becomes
it becomes a bit counterproductive.
Yeah So, like, and I feel like that is encompassed in this film in many ways, because there are aspects of this film that you're like, oh, it's quite refreshing to see a woman really enjoying sex, and then you have the ones where you're like, oh, she's not enjoying this at all, this is awful, why is she doing this?
Yes, like, you know? I do feel like that the film begins poorly, like, in that regard, because yeah. like, she gets, like, taught how to have sex by this, like, big burly hairy man. She's like, what is sex? And he's like, everyone must have sex. And I'm like, this feels a bit gross.
I'm so grateful for what you've done, I hardly know how to begin to thank you. I'm positive I could get you some sort of recompense from my government.
Well, you could let me make love to you.
That? But nobody's done that for centuries.
So, you won't do it?
Well, if you simply must insist, I guess so. But I can assure you there's really no point at all in doing it like this.
Without your garments, please.
Oh,
just, like, something we should note, like, consent is not always... If someone is consenting, they need to be actively saying yes to you rather than just not saying no to you.
Yeah, like, it's like an enthusiastic consent, not like a... Yeah, sure.
That definitely reads like someone who is deeply uncomfortable and doesn't really want to do it, but doesn't really have another option, so just does it.
Yes.
Which is not great.
No, okay.
But yes. Can I complain about another element of this?
Oh, no. Now I know how you felt during the St. Mary's episode.
I will reassure you with the fact that there are, as I've said, I will go on to talk about things I liked about this film. Specifically, okay. We're going to have a fashion watch moment and it's going to be glorious.
Okay, like, I'm still a bit scared.
It's just, and I wonder if this is something that has changed with the newer comics or even the older comics, because, you know, I have not read the comics.
Yes.
But I wish Barbarella was more competent, bearing in mind she's supposed to be one of the best agents in the galaxy.
Oh, yeah, because, like, you get this whole speech, like, at the beginning about, like, how she's, like, one of the best agents.
Yeah.
And then, like, her ship starts to crash, like, and she's like, I'm just going to, like, idly press some buttons. I'm not really sure.
It felt like a 1960s sci-fi joke about how women can't drive.
Oh, wow, it was, wasn't it?
Every time she gets in that fucking spaceship, it crashes.
Yeah, and then, like, when she crashes, like, she can never solve the problem.
I feel like if you're one of the top agents, your bare minimum requirement is you know how to fix your spaceship if it goes wrong.
Yeah, like, if, like, your main job, like, is to function alone.
Yes!
Then how? You should be self-sufficient.
She should be able, like, it's like if she was, like, drove all the time for work, she should know how to change a tire.
Yes.
It's the same thing.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Like, I just, that kind of annoyed me, that she just kept crashing and she just kept not knowing what to do. And, like, some man would come along and be like, I'll fix this for you. Maybe I'll ogle your breasts at the same time. Maybe this could end in sex as payment for my technological skills. And I'm like, she's an agent.
She's one of the top agents.
How does she not know how to fix a fucking spaceship?
I mean, in her defense, she does manually land on, like, an unfamiliar planet with that weird keyboard thing that she does.
But I also feel like she doesn't, especially in this whole search for Duran Duran and stuff like this, like, mostly I feel like she just sort of wanders about.
And then, like, randomly, like, stumbles into him, like, oh my god, it's you.
She has a lot of luck involved.
Yes, yes.
In just happening to bump into the correct people at the correct times.
Like, do you think that she has some, like, strange domino power where, like, things, like, just work out for her? She's like, I don't know, like, I'm just gonna go this way. And she's like, oh my god, Duran Duran, oh my god, it's you.
Oh, fancy seeing you. Yeah. So, like, I haven't put much effort into looking for you, but here you are.
Yeah, like, she has sex, like, 4 times on the way and is like, I was doing something here. Oh my god, there you are, I found you.
I mean, after she's had sex with some of the people, she is, like, do you know Duran Duran?
It's true.
So, like, I mean, fair, she is asking. Yeah, I just feel like maybe she should have more sleuthing ability, you know?
Yeah, like, that is something that they definitely do. Like, it's the part of the comic, the new comic.
Yeah.
That makes me feel like it's written by Mike Carey.
Yeah.
Because, like, she is, like, very much, like, a competent human being.
Yeah.
You can, like, understand why the creepy Prime Minister guy, like, at the beginning, why he calls her, like, one of the top agents.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
The new comic is done in the same way, where, like, each four issues, like, it seems to be the first three is, like, one arc of a story.
Yeah.
And that is very much, like, she is caught up in another strange and weird situation.
Yeah.
And, like, she has to, like, try to figure out this brand new work, which does very much, like, fit in with, like, what you've seen in the film.
Oh, I should say, I read that single issue of Barbarella that you sent me in the post that is riffing off of Scheherazade. So I have, like, a vague sense of what you mean by, like, the slightly different, like, gender portrayals. Because in that, she's very much, like, capable and controlling situations herself. She's, like, intelligent enough to have... I won't give you the plot of what I read because I don't want to spoil anything for anyone, but, like...
I mean, like, it's basically like 1001 Nights, isn't it?
It's a recreation of 1001 Nights. And just, like, she's able to intelligently assess the situation, keep the person distracted for long enough to have her backup option work out, and then she's all fine. Like, that's very much, like, active, in control type thing.
Yes, like, and that is very much present in the rest of the issues as well. But, like, which is what I really liked about it.
Yeah, like, I literally just read it before we started recording.
Okay.
But I can, like, already see the difference in passivity versus activity type thing.
Yeah, like, she's always like, I am in this, like, really weird situation.
Yeah.
And, like, I'm gonna, like, try to work out what is happening.
Yeah.
And, like, she is able to actually, like, react to a situation and then, like, make a decision, like, which seems like such a low bar.
But it is, like, she... it's just much more competent, much more like... And, you know, like, women are allowed to be stupid. It's just when they're the best secret agent in the galaxy, I feel like there's, like, a requirement. I'm not, like, we're not allowed to have women who aren't, like, Nobel scientists. I'm just saying, like, if you're billed as the top agent, I expect, like, a little bit of zing going on, you know?
Like, I expect you to be able to make choices based on observations.
Yeah. It was just, like, in the film, you know, there's the bit where they, like, go into, like, the city that's full of all the people being all sinful and stuff.
Yeah.
And she's just, like, burbling her way through.
Yeah, like, Pygar's there, like, should we be careful? And she's like, nah, let's
just
walk around.
Just walk through it, like, and, like, everyone can tell who she, like, she's not meant to be there because she's, like, this beautiful ray of silver purity.
Yes.
And it's just like, come on, girl, throw, like, a towel over you. You know, like, in Thor Ragnarok, and he disguises himself with a little cloak.
Mm-hmm.
Just do that. Throw something to hide the angel's wings.
Yep. But what, like, I was saying, like, about how the comic is structured, like, is the first three is an arc, then the fourth one is always like a one shot. I say always, like, we've had two arcs so far.
Okay.
And it's, like, done that both times. So, like, so far, like, it's always. But I don't know, like, it might change.
Yeah.
So then, like, you do get the chance to keep it very, like, episodic, where, like, where, like, you do get the one single issue stories, but then you do have chance to also let it breathe as well.
Yeah.
But, like, even though I say that I do really like how she is in the comic, I don't know how bad it is in the one that you have, because, like, I think it's done by a different artist.
Oh, okay.
But the main artist on the three issue arc so far, he always draws her, like, basically naked, and you can always see, like, her ass and her tits all the time. And I'm like, I don't know how to balance this, like, competent human being that I am seeing with this very, very sexualized person as well.
I feel like it's, like, this thing which we have at the moment where we've reached a point with, like, discussing, like, sexual politics and stuff, where it's like, there is nothing wrong with having a objectively complex female character who also enjoys sex, who is also depicted in a sexually desirable way.
Yes.
But things to hold in mind are like, who is creating the piece of media? Who is the intended audience for the piece of media? How are the power dynamics playing out? Stuff like, you know, like, just like with comics, there's like that whole thing, like the Hawkeye Initiative, where it's like, is this pose physically possible for a human being to embody, or are you being ridiculous and sexualizing something that if you saw in real life would horrify you?
Yes.
Like, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that element, I think, is really important in comics, when you're just like, is this physically possible for a human woman?
I feel like a lot of it for me is that, so the, like, base concept of Barbarella is that, like, if you really, really pare it down,
Yeah.
She goes on space adventures and she has sex with things.
Yeah.
So, like, if she is sexy all the time, then, like, when she has sex with something, then it doesn't have as much impact.
Okay.
So, for me, like, it's about the context that, like, okay. If she is always sexy, then she is never really sexy because, like, sexy, like, is the default.
I like it. It's, like, sort of, like, inceptioning itself. I don't know, like, sexy within sexy.
Like, it's like a double negative, you know? Like,
yeah, like, cancels itself out.
Sexy and sexy. Like, it's not sexy. So, like, it's obviously fine to have it, like, if the point of the scene is her having sex with someone.
Yeah.
Then, sure, make it, like, entirely sexy. Like, that's great. Yeah. But, like, if she's in, like, a gunfight and she's, like, running around with, like, tits like bouncing everywhere and like bends over a rock and like her ass is in your face and I'm just
for sure,
like
practical
not...
things.
Sorry?
I was just saying like for sure like practical things. Like yeah. You know, like it's like that whole debate with like what body armor are you giving women, and like a lot of the time it's stuff which would like just be very easy for them to die in, but because it looks visually great.
Yeah, like it's just about like she does not need to be sexy here for the story. Like yeah. Her being sexy here is just so that like men can ogle her and be like, yeah, that ass.
Yeah. I would like to say I do appreciate the fact that she's not strictly heterosexual.
Yeah, yeah.
Having read the, this is more in regards to the issue of the comic that you gave me, because mm-hmm. I read, I think, on the IMDb trivia that in the film, she is supposed to have had sex with the woman with the eye patch, but they cut all of it and there is, like, no video record of that.
As in, like, they destroyed the film of it, even.
They, like, destroyed the film. There's supposedly a still somewhere, but no one knows where it is.
Wow.
Which is, like, extreme.
I mean, like, you get the flirting on the point of view of the
You got
queen.
The flirting, yeah. But apparently that wasn't allowed.
Okay.
I appreciated with the comic that she is having sex with, like, people that you would, based on their appearance, assume to be male, female, and also, like, there were robots. There
yeah.
was, like, non-binary slash, like, much more ambiguous gendered people.
Mm-hmm.
And I just appreciated that it wasn't just entirely heterosexual, but that it was, like, she loves sex. Like, pansexual. You know, like, Captain Jack Harkness from, like, Torchwood, who's, like...
Yes.
That
yeah.
sort of vibe was what I got.
Yeah, like, that does very much carry over as well. That is in the original comic as well, to give it credit.
Yeah.
Like, she does sleep with people of all genders, like, as you've already said.
Yeah. I mean, and also, like, interesting that that is present in comics which are being published, like, in the 60s and stuff, which were
oh, yeah.
not necessarily the most welcoming time for us people who do not adhere to heterosexuality.
Yeah, I don't think it's... Because, like, I only read the first volume.
Yeah.
And it's not as explicit as it is with the men.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, like, more than implied.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
While we're talking, like, about the comic, can I just say, like, a few things about what I really, really like about it?
No, totally.
I really, really like the way that Mike Carey, like, interweaves all of these, like, background world-building things.
Okay.
Where, like, you get the idea that... Because the whole conceit is, like, we get, like, a brief snapshot of this one world.
Yeah.
So, like, he's always trying to, like, pull little, like, bits into it. So one example is that, like, at one point she's riding a robotic horse.
Yeah.
And then she compliments him, and then he's like, oh, so will you give me, like, a good rating on Mounted Musings then? And, like, it's just, like, an idea that, like, in this world, like, you rate the robot horses enough.
Yeah.
That it's got its own business. And, like, at some point, like, when she's trying to, like, hack into a computer, and it's just showing, as she describes it, season 8 of The Cowardly Clown. And then she comments about, like, how at that point the show has become, like, a piece of shit and, like, a shadow of what it once was.
Okay.
And then, like, in the second arc, like, right at the very end, like, when she's relaxing, like, she's, like, I'm lying in her bed and watching The Cowardly Clown.
Yeah.
So there's this, like, strange idea, like, of this, like, kids TV show that Barbarella still likes to watch and
yeah.
has, like, detailed thoughts about.
Oh, that's really cool.
And probably has a podcast about. Like, I'm going through it, like, one episode at a time, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you have anything else you want to say about the comic?
Like, not, like, in detail, I don't think. Like,
okay.
Just because, like, I could go into the, like, the story beats themselves and, like,
yeah.
the individual bits there. But just in general, like, it is a very, very well-crafted sci-fi comic. So, like,
yeah.
it does everything that you expect good sci-fi to do.
Yeah.
So, like, it explores these, like, varied concepts. And because you're in, like, a sci-fi world, like, you can, like, go into depth with them.
Yeah.
And, like, you don't have to worry, like, about, like, the realism of the world and the people. people because it's sci-fi. So, like, the first arc is, like, a discussion about, like, religious, like, extremism and how that can affect a society's reaction to sexuality.
Yeah.
And then, like, the whole, like, what is the cost of victory as well.
Yeah.
So, like, it does cover, like, a lot, like, in three issues.
Yeah.
Like, it's just far more deep than you would expect a Barbarella comic to be.
I mean, from the tiny bit I read, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Did you like her little pet?
Yes. I don't really understand the pet, but I liked it. I also liked, as you said, with like these details of world building, the concept of the 1001 Nights, their plotline is obviously that she tells the story. So she tells three different stories. And each world that is shown in each story had some really intriguing concepts, even though they're just like briefly touched on. You know, they're not even like the whole sole focus of one issue of a comic. But even then, like there were these three really individual and unique concepts for world building just within one issue. So like I was like suitably impressed to be like, oh, this is cool.
Yeah, yeah. To bring it back, like, very briefly to her pet. So she has this little creature that she picks up called a dog mouse.
Okay.
And it's called Vix.
Yeah.
And there's this, like, long-running, like, background plot that, like, I really hope is going to, like, turn into something at some point.
Yeah.
Where it claims to be non-sentient. And from its behavior, it's constantly, like, becoming, like, more and more clear by the way that, like, it, like, intercedes to help her.
Yeah.
Because, like, its whole thing is that, like, it can just repeat the words that it's already heard.
Yeah.
But the ones that it chooses, like, in the way that it, like, chooses to order them. Because, like, it's, like, technically repeating.
Yeah.
But, like, it's, like, very clearly thinking.
That was definitely clear at the end of this one comic.
Yeah, like, it makes, like, some joke about, like, how Vix is hacked into this guy who's keeping her hostage, but is claiming that she's just, like, randomly, like, pressing buttons on the keyboard.
Yeah, I didn't know that this was an ongoing thing, but there was definitely the, like, is it sentient, is it not sentient type thing going on.
And, like, it very obviously is, but, like, I love the kind of recurring joke of Barbarella, like, asking her.
Yeah.
And then her going, not sentient, and then Barbarella going, like, I believe you, sure.
Did you have anything else to say about the comic? Do you want to go back to the film?
I feel like we should go back to the film. I feel like you are going to have like a lot of thoughts on the fashion in this film.
Well, this does seem like a perfect time for Sophie's Fashion Watch. I thought I would break with Fashion Watch tradition, because what normally happens in Fashion Watch is I pick out like one or two items of fashion which I'm particularly enthralled with. I describe them and I mostly just go, isn't it fabulous?
Yes.
Whereas, and like the thing is with this, with the fashion of this is so iconic. It's so, even like the bits where you're like, this is a bit weirdly sexualized, still here for it. The only fashion bit I, off the top of my head, don't love is the weird fur arrangement she wears where she looks like a giant skunk.
Okay.
I wasn't so into the skunk look.
I liked the recurring joke of it getting caught in things.
Oh yeah, no, that was genuinely funny.
Yes.
But I just didn't like it as like a fashion accessory.
Like, I'm surprised that you don't hate the one boobed thing.
Oh, which one was the one boob?
Like, she has like some like space armor, but like one boob is exposed.
Yeah, and like, I'll be honest with you, it's not practical in any way. I acknowledge that none of these things are practical. However, they are iconic for a reason.
Yeah.
I particularly like the green piece. That's just like very interesting. And I specifically want to talk about its relation to like retrofuturism and how it's come to embody like what retrofuturism like is. Retrofuturism is essentially what we call these, and I'm so sorry if I've got this wrong, but it's what we call like these visions of the future that were created in what is now retro to us. So like these 1960s visions of the future, like even like going so far back to like the 1930s visions of the future and stuff, there is this particular like aesthetic, which if you were to see images of retrofuturism, you would be like, oh yes, of course, like I'm so familiar with this concept, this idea of the future.
Mm-hmm.
Barbarella is like a really key image in that, and I find retrofuturism very interesting now because I think it has this really optimistic view of what the future would be like.
Okay.
In many ways it's still mired in like the morality of the time in which it's developed. So like with Barbarella, it's this view of the future, but it still has all the gender roles of the 60s in it and stuff like that. But like aesthetically, we had just such hopes for what the future was going to be and what technology was going to be available to us.
Okay.
And like where we'd be living and traveling and all stuff like this, that it's just like there's this nostalgia to retrofuturism and this, I don't know, I feel like a lot of our futuristic stuff now, we're exploring these futures that are a bit darker, a bit grittier.
Mm.
Sometimes they can feel a little bit hopeless in many times.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Although there are like lots of the fears of the 60s and stuff like put into it.
Yeah.
I feel like it's just when you look at retrofuturism now, I don't feel like innocence is the right word, but there's this sort of like naivety to it in many ways in some form. I don't know if I'm just projecting.
No.
Her fashion is not practical, whereas a lot of our futuristic media now has very practical, focused fashion in it. And I have a book which I got for my birthday, which is super wonderful, which is called The Fashion of Film, How Cinema Has Inspired Fashion by Amber Butcher. And Amber Butcher is a fashion historian who is utterly fabulous and does lots of stuff with the BBC and is just brilliant. I highly recommend her.
Mm-hmm.
And just like, I just wanted to pick out like a couple of like key points that she makes about this, because she has a chapter on Barbarella, and most of what that looks at is like its legacy on how it affected like fashion after the film came out.
Okay.
Just a couple of things to note. The costumes in this are by Jacques Fonteray, who also did the costumes for Moonraker, which is the Bond film which involves being in space. So he's obviously like a guy who likes his space fashion.
Okay, yeah.
But it's also inspired by Paco Rabanne, and you can see a lot of inspiration like from Paco Rabanne runways post-Barbarella that still draw on it. But this is just a really interesting fact that she included in it. So like, obviously, a lot of retrofuturism and stuff like this, silver is like something we really associate with like futuristic fashion. She includes a little thing here, which is like, silver had been the colors of cinematic space travel since Flash Gordon in the 1930s. They had become so associated with spaceflight in the popular imagination that early spacesuits for Mercury missions were sprayed silver or coated with aluminium powder to look more photogenic and paradoxically more authentic.
Wow.
So I just think it's worth noting this way that our perceptions of what is official and what is futuristic and stuff then gets fed back into reality. So like the whole reason that those spacesuits in real life were silver is because on cinema screens we made them silver, so when the public and stuff are viewing them in reality, they're like, but it doesn't look proper, does it? It's not silver.
It's not real enough.
And I just think that's like so interesting.
That's so human, you know, like,
yeah,
like you want reality to be like a shaped version of reality.
Yeah. And then I have two further points. One of them is that like, obviously this was highly influential on another fashionable sci-fi film that we have previously talked about, which is The Fifth Element.
Okay.
Which is Jean-Paul Gaultier, but he has acknowledged like the inspiration that Barbarella and that sort of fashion had on the designs in that film.
Mm-hmm.
So like another example of our visions of sci-fi and future being fed into each other and being based on like cinematic visions rather than like, you know, what actually our lived experience of technology is.
Okay.
And then also just an acknowledgement that the fashion was one of the key aspects of promotion in the film, because they did offshoots of the costumes were designed for Alexander's department store in Manhattan as part of the film's publicity. And there was like, we talk about, oh, isn't the fashion ridiculous, blah, blah, blah. But during this time of great change in fashion with the invention of the miniskirt and the invention of like the bikini and stuff like this, like women's liberation as seen through fashion, Barbarella can be viewed as like an extension of that in many ways.
I mean, like, I feel like it's like with a lot of, when you look at like a lot of like high fashion runways, like, and you think like, these are not clothes, but like that like filters through,
It filters down and it becomes something that is wearable and worn.
Yes.
So like no one's expecting you to go about in like a plastic boob top, but like maybe some of the silhouettes that were used in the film then become something that's translated to like practical fashion.
Like, do you reckon that the like one boob plastic thing became like a one highlighted, like subtly highlighted boob?
Well, I mean, like, but just stuff like having plastic used in fashion became a thing. That's still a thing that happens in like our futuristic portrayals. Like that outfit, and then look at Lilou's bandage outfit. Like, could we say that one is less revealing than, like, they're both equally revealing and sexualizing, it's just like updated for the contemporary time that we're at.
True.
You know, I think those are all my fashion watch points. I just feel like this is quite a notable film for its fashion, and I think its fashion is one of the things that turned it into a cult classic, because if you did the same thing but with shit fashion, probably wouldn't be as fun.
That is very true. Part of the fun, like part of, like, as you say, the campiness, like, is that she somehow keeps changing outfits.
Yeah. And you're like, where are you getting this from, babe?
Like, how do you have, like, six outfits on this, like, space station that you don't know what it is?
Yeah. You know, it's part of it. Yeah. It's part of what makes it fun and, like, all kitsch and stuff. Is like, oh, another outfit change.
Of course it is. Yeah. Now, like, her boobs out. Of course it is. Yeah.
Anyway, that's the end of Sophie's Fashion Watch.
I do want to end the discussion of Barbarella with, I think, my favourite line.
Okay.
It's when she just gets into the space station and she's, like, doing her, like, vague wandering around thing that she does. And then she hears, like, a scream, like, in the background. Like, and she goes...
That's screaming. A good many dramatic situations begin with screaming.
Like, that was, like, a very, like, suddenly, like, breaking the fourth wall kind of line. And I really loved it.
That was a good line. There were moments where I was like, oh, that's a good line.
Yeah.
Most of the dialogue I was not blown away by.
Yeah.
But that was a good one.
Yep.
Okay. Do you want to move on to Dogfight?
So we've talked about the pros and cons of the portrayal of Barbarella.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are definitely parallels, but there are also very much, like, differences in how it, like, approaches a female protagonist.
These are quite different films, and when me and Mr. S sat down to watch Dogfight, he was a little confused about why we were talking about both of these films at the same time.
Yes.
Like, I picked up that we were talking about, like, gender politics and stuff like this, mm-hmm. but, like, Mr. S was just like, why?
Are they going to go into space at some point?
It was like when it was like Vietnam War, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. It was like,
Yeah, like, I'm part of why I am bringing this in.
Yeah.
Is just because I've been trying to, like, talk about it for a while. And I'm like, it kind of connects.
That is literally this entire podcast. Would you like to do an introduction so that any of our listeners who have not somehow gone from Barbarella to Dogfight have any idea what we're talking about?
Okay. Dogfight is a film starring River Phoenix and Lily Taylor that follows a group of young American soldiers on their last night in San Francisco, just before they are shipped out to fight in the Vietnam War. The soldiers arrange an event called a dogfight, where they each attempt to find the ugliest date to bring to a dance, with River Phoenix's character, Eddie, choosing to bring the reserved but secretly talented Rose as a last-ditch effort. However, Eddie is soon shown the error of his ways and attempts, however meagerly, to make it right. So, what do you think about Dogfight, Sophie? I think that, like, I'm the most afraid of what you think about Dogfight because I feel like it somehow means more to me. So you might, like, properly offend me now, so
can I produce a theory?
I don't like that, like, you have to, like, qualify your answer to this film.
No. I have a theory.
Okay.
You like this film, don't you?
I do.
Do you like this film because it's comprised of a couple where one couple calls the other person out on their shit all the time? Because that is something that you have previously stated on this podcast that you enjoy.
No. Like, it's
okay.
Not.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because as I was watching this, I was like, is this what's happening? Is this why he likes it?
Have I got a type of film?
It was just, I remember you saying, I think it was in our Back to the Future episode.
Yeah, it was.
And I remember
you
giving that description. And I was like, is this what's happening?
No, because the reason why I feel like this comes into the problematic female lead is that when you look at the plot of this film, so, like, Rose begins the film, she thinks that she needs to get some validation from, like, an external source.
Okay.
And by the end of the film, she has grown to realize that her self-worth doesn't come from somebody else. Like, it comes from herself.
Okay.
So, like, she has, like, the character arc.
Yes.
But the vast majority of the film is dedicated to Eddie, who, because, like, right at the end of the film, like, even after he goes through this, like, quote-unquote, like, redemptive night where he treats Rose
like a human being.
Yes.
You could say.
When she gives him her address to write to him.
Oh, yes.
He tears it up. And he jumps, like, right back into how he was acting, like, with his friends before.
Yes.
So, like, that choice to tear up her address is him committing to being the same person that he was at the beginning of the film. So, like, that's where, like, I get the problematic thing.
Can I unpick?
Yes,
So first, okay, right. I understand you are not supposed to like the concept of the film.
Yes, the dogfight.
At the same time, was infuriated by the dogfight. Mm-hmm. But What mostly infuriates me about the dogfight as depicted is our depiction of ugly women. First of all, I will say, I think there is great power in being an ugly woman and in rejecting the fact that as a woman you're supposed to look beautiful or adhere to beauty standards, etc., etc. I think it's very freeing to throw all that out the window and be like, fuck it, I'm going to go outside like a grimy goblin because I give zero shits.
Yes.
Speaking, that's what I do in my life a great amount of the time. Uh-huh. I will say, this is very much a Hollywood idea of what being ugly is.
Like, it's a lot of stereotypes.
Most of them are women who are attractive women who they've just given a bad perm or a backcomb to and some glasses. One of them is just a normal Native American woman.
Yes.
One of them is a man in drag. One of them is a genuinely old woman. Most of the rest of them are just attractive women who maybe have... She has a slightly larger than average nose. She has frizzy hair and glasses.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just like to acknowledge that these are, like, entirely acceptable things to have. Like, number one, it's fine to be ugly. But also, number two, if you're going to bring up loads of ugly women, none of these women were really ugly. Like, most of them are conventionally attractive. They're, like, skinny white people most of the time.
Because, like, part of what it tries to do in the film is, like, it doesn't tell you what the dogfight is from the offset.
Yeah.
Because, like, what they're trying to do is to, like, pull you in and then, like, point the finger, like, at you and be like, oh, look how horrible you are.
Yeah.
For thinking of them this way.
I wasn't thinking that they were ugly.
Yeah, like, it's not done very well.
It was just a very limited view on, like, attractive women are all supermodels, and anyone else who is not of supermodel standard, therefore, can be qualified to be part of the dogfight.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt like it was just very funny in many ways that you're like, oh, this is what you think an ugly woman is.
Like,
just
human
because
being.
Well, it's like, oh, she's not had her hair done at a salon and she's got a slightly big nose, therefore she's an ugly woman. I don't know. Like, it was just performance of femininity not achieved, therefore ugly.
Yes. Well, like, that's part of the point with Rose, that, like, you wouldn't look at her, like, and think, like, oh, how hideous. Like, she's just, like, a...
She's a pretty woman. Have you seen that woman? She is a very pretty woman.
I've not seen her, not in this film.
She's very pretty.
Okay.
She's, like, an entirely, like, Hollywood acceptable pretty woman.
Okay.
And then I also understand that we're making a point about the trappings of masculinity.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that, like, these people, although Eddie in private with this one woman is prepared to show her more nuance and to step outside of his box and to, like, redeem himself in little air quotation marks.
Yes.
He is also essentially a child who's been recruited to the army and is about to be put in a horrific situation.
Oh, yeah.
And all of this stuff. And he is therefore trapped by that into then performing this ultra masculine identity, which is part of why he rips up her thing, etc. In many ways, like, as a coping mechanism for the fact that he's a child about to go to war and he could die.
Yeah, like, I absolutely do understand that, yes.
Yeah, so, like, although I watch this and I'm like, Eddie, you're still a dickhead.
Mm-hmm.
I also understand the point we're making there as well, and that we are making a point about, like, the exploitation of what is children. You know, they try and emulate what they think men do because, like, they may never get to be a man because mm-hmm. they might die.
Yeah. Well, like, this film, I don't know, like, if you know, but, like, it's been turned into, like, a musical as well.
I had heard of that, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, it's got songs written by the same people who did Dear Evan Hansen and The Greatest Showman. So, like, you know these people. And the songs were all, like, really great. And to the end that you just mentioned, where they are doing this, like, performative thing.
Yeah.
Like, and there's a song, like, at the beginning, like, of the second act called, like a homecoming ticker tape parade. I can't remember the name right now. I'll play a bit of it now. You win a war, you pick a wife, you get respect your whole damn life. You're a hometown hero. And that is very much a song about, like, why they are behaving this way. That they have been promised this whole, when they come back from this war, like a whole show and a whole, like, people are going to worship me.
Yeah, it very much taps into something we talked about in our Iliad episode, which is like this concept of like kleos, that's like an ancient Greek concept, which is like, it's the trade-off. You sign up and you put your life on the line and you risk potentially dying, and then you are given in return, should you survive, adoration, glory, reward, etc. But like, the thing about the Vietnam War is that that's not what you got.
Yes, like, and we know from the point like we are that,
yeah,
like where this is going for them.
Yeah, which is like the extra sadness is that you understand that even though he's fulfilling his part of the bargain and he's like playing up to the macho role and blah 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 blah, like when he comes out of it, as you see, the tide has turned. And although there are the old guys in the bar who are like, thank you for your service, blah, because of the time period that it's set in, there are also all the people for whom the Vietnam War, it's like, oh, you know, the guy who was like, kill many babies while you were out there and blah blah blah, and it's like, he in many ways has done his bit, but he's not getting the rewards that he was promised. At the same time, that doesn't excuse the fact that the dogfight is a extremely shitty, misogynistic thing to do.
Yes.
Like, I'm not saying these things like, this film is shit because the dogfight is a horrible idea. Like, you're not supposed
to think that's the point. Yeah.
I'm just making it clear to you that I'm not like, I hate this film. I'm just like acknowledging that it is showing you something and it's expecting you to be critical of it. It's not giving, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. But like, how do you feel about Rose as like the female lead, like, of the film?
I don't really understand why Rose and Eddie like each other.
Does this come back to your like, oh, can they have a conversation thing?
It does. Yes. You know, like I can understand how they could spend an evening together like they did. And because they are quite different people, ideal-wise, you have the kid who signed up to go to war versus the girl who likes folk singers who traditionally are singing songs that are very anti-war and who would be involved in politics that are very anti-war. Like, she expresses opinions that are to do with, like, why can't we talk this through peacefully, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. I can understand how, for a night, when you are so diametrically different to each other, there is an interest in engaging. Because, you know, like, they do call each other out on their shit because they're able to see clearly through, like, what the other person is saying. And I can understand that you could spend a night and, like, bouncing off each other. That would be, like, interesting and stuff. At the end, when they, like, meet up again, I don't see how that would be a lasting relationship.
I don't know if it's, like, intended to be.
I'm not saying that it's necessarily telling you that it's gonna be that. I'm just, like, at this point, they've both been through further experiences, and it's, like, a question of, would they be able to do that again, or are they too far gone to be able to actually repeat that experience?
I feel like the fact that Rose has now become some degree of seniority, or, like, does she own the cafe that she
wanted to? Yeah, I think she does.
Yeah, so, like, she's, like, fully moved on from, like, not the delusions of, like, being a teenager. Where, like, she, like, wants to become a singer because she might still be pursuing that, and we don't really know.
Yeah.
But, like, she, from the very, like, brief part of that we see of her, like, she seems happy to be at home, to be in the cafe, to run the cafe. Like, she has, like, made these choices to validate herself based on herself and, like, her own views of how she wants to live her life.
Yeah.
So, like, I feel like she took from that one night... She went on that character growth because of that night.
Yeah.
And, like, she is now very much a different person than she was when they first met. So, like, I can't imagine that there would be anything there either, no.
Yeah. Can I also say that the song choice of Don't Think It's Twice, It's All Right was actually very well placed. It's right towards the end when he does the running down the street and stuff. It's the Bob Dylan song that plays.
But I wish there was something you would do or say, try and make me change my mind and stay. But we never did too much talking anyway. But don't think twice, it's all right.
Lyrically, very much tying into, like, what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, I have a fondness for 60s folk music.
Okay.
Folk rock.
Like, do you think that the film treats her fairly? So, like in terms of screen time, like, he gets, like, a lot more screen time and focus than she does.
I feel like the film has set out to tell us the story of man going into Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel like I expected... I don't feel like I expected Rose to be obscenely fleshed out, because I feel like from the get-go, you don't... It's not about her.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that's good or bad. I just wasn't surprised when she didn't turn out to be more than what she is.
So, like, in terms of what we're trying to, like, pick apart, like, in terms of gender in films here.
Okay, yeah.
So, is it the, because the context is, this is a film about Eddie.
Yeah.
But she is still, like, complex for the context in which she is in.
I feel like she's more complex than she could have been, although I'm not, like, this is the pinnacle of female writing.
Yes.
You know, if that makes sense? Like, I think it would have been very easy for them to give someone who was much more one-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
But I also don't think she's a particularly wonderful character. But then we're also only getting, like, a one-night snapshot of her.
Yes, yes. So what I do like about what these songs do, like, in the musical is that...
Yeah.
Because, like, that is how, like, I first, like, experienced it, is through the songs. And I feel like she gets a lot more song time. So, like, I feel like I was surprised when, like, I saw the film that she wasn't as prominent. Like, just because I was coming in from where, like, she gets the vast majority of the songs. So that's where my point of view of, like, how she was, like, problematic, because she was very prominent. But she was also very much, like, in Eddie's story.
Whereas I think because I've come in straight away with the film, mm-hmm. and I've been like, okay, this is a film from the 90s. It's about a bloke going to war. I think I was more like, oh, the woman speaks. I'm sorry, but you know, like, there's like 90s films where, like, I know this isn't like a romantic comedy type thing.
Yeah.
But, like, there are elements of a rom-com to this,
mm-hmm.
In their relationship and the development of it and blah.
But with no comedy involved.
Yes, but there are a lot of, like, rom-coms in the 90s where there is much less to the woman, and mostly she's beautiful and enigmatic and the man falls hopelessly in love with her and projects onto her.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas at least with this one, it's like, she's a normal woman who has interests, like, singing, and she actually, like, has some conversations. So I think I went into it and I was like, okay, like, she at least is a person a little bit. In the musical, she's using her own voice to express her own inner feelings, whereas in this I never feel like we're really getting her inner feelings. We're just sort of getting, like, her reacting to Eddie.
Yes, yes. Can I talk about some of my favorite songs from the musical?
Yeah.
So the song that I first heard was called First Date Last Night. Like, it's kind of a duet because it's both Eddie and Rose singing.
Yeah.
But, like, as you can tell from the title, he's singing about his last night and she's singing about her first date.
Yeah.
And it's got this, like, because it's, like, kind of a duet but not, like, it's so jumpy and awkward that, like, it, like, really, like, effectively portrays a first date that they both kind of don't want to be on.
Yeah.
So take her out.
Give him a shot.
Cause people can surprise you. Or not.
And then what the musical, like, also does is, like, you know in the film that there's that very brief conversation between her and the prostitute.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, one of the soldiers has paid a prostitute to come and be his date to the dogfight. Because he knows that, like, her front teeth come out and she can, like, dull herself down a bit.
Yeah.
And in the musical, like, they have, like, a lot more, like, of a conversation.
Yeah.
And, like, there's a song called Dogfight, actually.
Yeah.
Where the prostitute, like, is like, this is how the world is. And, yeah. like, we're all gonna get fucked, but, like, at least I'm gonna get paid.
Yeah.
But, like, this song is, like, the beginning of Rose being like, but, like, why does the world have to be like that? Like,
yeah.
This shouldn't be the way that the world is.
No, you can't give in and you can't play dumb. When you get thick skin, then you're quick to numb. You let them win and a dog's what you become.
The whole time I was watching this, I just kept thinking about, I recently went to see Miss Saigon at the theatre,
okay.
which is set in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, and the main character are, like, Vietnamese prostitutes and stuff.
Mm.
And I just had that in my brain a lot of the time because, like, this is, like, the pre part, and then
okay.
Miss Saigon focuses on an American GI and a Vietnamese woman who fall in love, and then shenanigans ensue.
Mm. Like, can you picture, like, a world where they exist, like, in the same universe?
Like, I kind of was. That's okay. The problem is, I was kind of like, okay, he's gonna go to Vietnam, and then when we're in Vietnam, this whole plot line's gonna happen.
Yeah, like, immediately a slonga, like, it'll be great.
Yeah, yeah. And then all of this stuff, they'll sing together, blah blah blah. And yeah, so, like, it's just this weird duality I have in my mind that I just feel like I need to go on record that, like, I wasn't maybe paying the most attention to Dogfight because I kept thinking about Miss Saigon instead.
Miss
At the end of each episode, we each assign a number of flailings to the thing that we've been discussing. Sophie, how many flailings do you give Barbarella and maybe Dogfight if you want to?
I'm going to give Barbarella 5 and Dogfight 4.
Ooh, ouch.
As we always say,
yes,
a large proportion of the number of flailings is how obsessed with something are you.
Yes, yes.
And I am obsessed with neither of these things. However, I gave Barbarella more because I could talk more about the fashion.
Okay. So, like, you, like, enjoyed them.
Yeah.
But, like, you're not going to watch them again.
Yeah, probably. Like, yeah. I had a... if someone was to come to me and be like, oh, I watched that film Dogfight last night, I would, like, have a conversation with them about it and be like, blah, 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 what did you think? Let's chat about it.
Yeah.
But I'm not probably actively going to go out and, like, rewatch them.
Okay. Like, do you think that conversation is ever going to happen?
Well, if it does, I'm prepared. Like, Barbarella, I could see that
yes.
happening, insofar as I also spoke to my dad about it last night.
Okay.
When I mentioned that I was recording this podcast on Barbarella, we had a whole conversation about his opinion on Barbarella.
Okay.
So that already did happen. But Dogfight will be interesting to see if I ever have that moment, but I'm prepared if it does.
I would recommend giving the soundtrack a try.
Oh, now that you've talked about the musical, I will check out the musical. That does sound interesting. How about you?
I think I would give Barbarella a 7.
Yeah.
So I am currently like obsessed with the comic.
Yeah.
But the film and the original comic that we didn't really touch on.
Yeah.
I didn't really like as much.
Okay.
As I really like the comic.
Yeah.
So that's why, like, as a whole, I'm going to, like, average it out a bit.
Yeah.
And Dogfight, I think I'm going to give it 5.
Ooh.
Like, just because, like, I really did want to talk about it.
But, yeah.
Like, as you made the point, like, I'm not going to watch the film over and over again.
Yeah.
Because, like, I did like it. And, like, it did, like, emotionally affect me.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to watch it for a while, probably.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I've chosen, like, two topics. Then, like, at the end, gone, yeah, it's all right. You
but
know?
Like, I feel like sometimes, and I've said this before, sometimes I find it harder to do a podcast episode on something that I 100% loved because all you have to say is, I liked it.
I know. Like, there are so many topics that, like, I might have chosen.
Yeah.
But, like, I feel like it wouldn't go on for very long.
It'll
like,
be
it's
really
like,
boring.
It's really good, isn't it? It's really good.
Whereas something like this, you're like, there's a lot to pick apart. There's a lot to discuss. Like, we don't have to do podcast topics on stuff that we adore with our whole heart. We can do, like, I really want to talk to you about it because I've got some shit to say.
Yeah, yeah. Like, that's why, like, I feel like I'm never going to do one on Zelda. Like, even though it's, like, in our cover photo.
Yeah.
Like, just because, like, it would start. Like, you would get the theme music. And then, like, I would go, it's good, innit? Then, like, it would cut out again.
Yeah.
And that's the end of this episode of You Know What I Like. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher, and please leave a rating and a review. It helps some other people to find the show, and we'd love to be able to flail out more people.
We hope that you've enjoyed listening to us ramble, and please follow the podcast on Twitter at YKWILpodcast, or drop us an email at YKWILpodcast@gmail.com. Come back next month where we get overly excited about Charmed.
See you then!